Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
But the wild world was calling, so I said that I'd go. So I left old Black County just to search for my soul. Yeah, I left old Black County just to search for my soul.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Amy Garland and Bonnie Montgomery? You like Amy and Bonnie? Amy Garland and Bonnie Montgomery are no strangers to being premier singer-songwriters individually, but this is the first time the two of them have played together publicly, besides on Amy's front porch. More can be found at Reverb Nation and BonnieMontgomeryMusic.com. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack in the River Market District of downtown Little Rock, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my left here playing for us tonight is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has shared the stage with the late Johnny Winter, among many others. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here behind me? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, so tonight's featured artist is mosaic artist Stephanie Darnell, and our featured piece is this piece right over here, the red and yellow one, entitled Sunset, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Stephanie at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our storytellers find themselves saying, in one way or another, well, not exactly. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Daniel Kohler stumbles into a situation that he never expected, and will end the night with Alan Reese and a night he wants to recreate. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Dina Nall at the doctor's office, and yet another mix-up in The Gynecological Misadventures of Adina.
Flipping through a four-month-old issue of Southern Living, I waited for my name to be called. This was my yearly OBGYN checkup at a Little Rock clinic that prides itself on being a Christian place of business. So women like me can pay to get groped to the glory of God, I guess. As I sat against a backdrop of regulation jumbo floral print wallpaper, a vague feeling of dread began to form in my stomach, not because of the exam. Once you've given birth a couple of times, going in for a routine checkup is no big deal. What I dreaded was having to correct the staff on how to pronounce my name. For the record, my name is spelled D-E-A-N-A, and it is pronounced Dina. It's Dean with an And my last name is Nall, like Mall with an N. It's not that complicated. Unless I'm in a doctor's office. This is where I become Deanna, Deanne, Gina, Jeannie, Tina, Dee Dee, Dana, Deanie, anything but my actual name. At last year's appointment at this clinic, a nurse walked into the waiting room and called for Deanne Hall. I sat for a second, looking around to see if an actual Deanne Hall was going to stand up. When no one did, I approached the nurse. "If you mean Dina Nall, that's me," I said. 1 year later, as I sat in this waiting room again, I didn't expect anyone here to remember how to say my name, so I thought I was prepared for what was to come. A receptionist called me to the sign-in desk to ask me if I brought my forms. "Actually, I was never sent anything," I said. So she gave me some new forms, and I sat down to fill them out. A few seconds later, I heard, "Jeannie." I looked up and realized that she meant me. I approached her desk to once again clear up my name, but she kept talking. "Jeannie, I think you didn't get your forms in the mail because we have an old address for you," she said. "Are you still living in Lone Oak?" "I've never lived in Lone Oak," I said. Is your date of birth 11-2-54? She asked. 1954? I asked. I wasn't trying to be rude, but first they messed up my name and now they added almost 20 years to my age. Turns out the confusion surrounding my name had caused the office staff to confuse me with another patient. But with my help, the receptionist got it all straightened out. At least I hope she did. I would hate for my pap smear to show precancerous cells on my cervix and Jeannie and Lono getting the phone call instead of me. Then I sat down and returned to reading Southern Living until I heard, Deanna Hall? I walked up to the nurse who greeted me with a cheery, hello, how are you today? I'm great, I said, but I need to let you know that I'm not really Deanna Hall. I'm Dina Nall. I just respond to the name that sounds the most like mine. The nurse looked quite puzzled and said, let me check on that. I'll be right back. A minute later, she returned with a triumphant look on her face. You're right. It's Dina Nall. I was right about my very own name. What a moment. Then I was ushered to a bathroom where I had to roll my eyes when I realized I was peeing into a cup labeled Dana Hall. And rolling your eyes while peeing into a cup is not easy. You should try it sometime. Once in the exam room, I glanced at my chart and anything else with my name on it to make sure it was right, in case the real Dana Hall was scheduled for major surgery that morning. But everything checked out. Dina C. Nall, my official, legal, correctly spelled name, was on everything. So maybe, just possibly, they finally got it. Maybe I wouldn't ever have to explain my name to these people again. Then the same nurse poked her head into the room. I'll be right back, Deanne, she said. I give up. You people can call me whatever you want.
Mislabeled pap smears aside, Dina Nall actually likes her name very much. She is a freelance writer for a number of publications and teaches writing at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock and Pulaski Technical College. Next on Tales from the South, Daniel Kohler's curiosity leads him to not exactly what he expected in The Bear in the Mimosa Tree.
I'm up early that Saturday morning. Daddy is already down at the bakery and Mama's still in bed. I turn on TV, but cartoons aren't on yet. Just that picture of the Indian chief and the bullseye while they play the music you say Pledge of Allegiance to. I'm in the second grade, so I know how to say it. The biggest word I used to know was furniture. Now it's allegiance. It's a way more important word than furniture. I hit the screen door and search the backyard for my basketball. I find it over by the mimosa tree where my baby brother, Ralphie, claims he saw the bear. He ran inside screaming bloody murder to Mama, and she locked the door and made Daddy go look. Turns out it was just a cat. Ralphie calls everything with fur on it a bear. I take some shots at the hoop Daddy nailed up on the side of our house, underhanded with both hands like Wilt Chamberlain. I can't throw it high enough any other way. The big kid two houses over has a real gold in his backyard. Bobby Ray is 12 and an only child. He says he's working on his jump shot and he'll probably go pro when he grows up. He acts like he's my big brother and that's all right by me. His daddy keeps rabbits in little wire cages, and sometimes Bobby Ray lets me pet the baby ones. Their poop looks like raisins. Bobby Ray's daddy did something really bad back there. I saw the whole thing, and it made me sick to my stomach. See, I was crawling around by his fence looking for roly-polies and snails, and I guess he didn't see me under the bushes. He pulled a big white rabbit out of his cage by the fur behind its neck, and I guess it knew what was coming because it screamed real loud. It sounded as terrified as Ralphie did when he saw the bear in the mimosa tree. Bobby Ray's daddy held the rabbit down on the table and knocked it in the head with a piece of wood. It twitched and then lay still. He cut the fur behind the neck and then stripped it away like you do when you pull off your t-shirt and it goes all inside out. That skin rabbit on the table looked as smooth and naked as a baby. I was hoping it would wake up. But it never did. So every Easter when his daddy puts up the rabbits for sale sign in the front yard, I remember what I saw him do. How dumb can you get? I just thought his daddy was in the Easter bunny business. I decided to punt the basketball over the garage, but the kick's not high enough, and it bounces into Carolyn's yard next door. Carolyn's in third grade. She's bigger than me and scratches and bites when we fight. Last Sunday, I got so mad at her, I put my football shoulder pads and helmet on and then dared her to wrestle. She still whipped me, even in her nice church dress. But Carolyn's all right, and we play together a lot. Her mama's pretty, but then again, she's a beautician. Carolyn sometimes has a daddy, but never for long. I heard Mama say, Wanda never has any luck with men because she just seems to keep marrying the same darn guy. I didn't even know you could marry somebody more than once. Carolyn's pretty. Her mother lets her wear powder and lipstick, but that stuff rubs right off when we play dog pile, chase, and king of the mountain. Afterwards, her face looks like someone colored outside the lines. Hey, she yells at me through her screen door. Get out of our yard. Shut up. I'm just getting my ball. You shut up. She's out the door like a jackrabbit, and I'm like, But all she says is, your daddy got a shovel? Yeah. Well, go get it. I do as I'm told. I let Carolyn boss me around because she usually comes up with neat stuff to do. Once, we played doctor in the neighbor's garage. It was fun. I got to be the patient. I bring the shovel and follow her through the honeysuckle bushes behind her house. That old man up on the hill, Carolyn says, I think he buries his money behind his shed. We dig some holes, but no money. Trust me, Danny, there's money buried here. I don't argue with Carolyn about money. She already knows how to make change in her mother's beauty parlor. So we keep digging, and soon broken buttercups and muddy rocks lay amid the dirt clods. Then a door slams, and we peek around the corner of the shed. The old man's standing in his backyard, staring our way. Coughing, he spits out something yellow. Run, Carolyn whispers and pushes me into the honeysuckle hedge. Squatting in there, we watch the house. The old man looks around a minute, but then goes back inside, just mumbling. Carolyn breaks off a honeysuckle branch and pulls out the little feeler thing from the flower. Taste it, she says. I lick the tiny drop of sweet syrup from its tip. It's all right, but it takes a lot of honeysuckle feelers to get a good taste. Carolyn's eyes go wide. You want to go see a crazy man? Yeah, where? Miss Parker's cellar. He's crazy as he can be. He smells bad and wears dirty clothes. I swallow hard. I will if you will. Carolyn nods, so we sneak through Miss Parker's yard. First, we hide behind the big statue of a little boy peeing into the goldfish pond. Run up there and hide, she says. So I army crawl to the bird bath and curl up under it. It's a fat, naked baby made of concrete that holds up the bird bath with his fingertips. Carolyn runs to the garage and I follow. On the wall of the garage is a giant pair of scissors, a tool with metal alligator teeth, and a curved metal blade with a long wooden handle. Carolyn puts her finger across her lips and I follow her down three steps to an unlit room with a dirt floor. I can barely see her in the dark and hold on to her shirt tail. Suddenly, she stops and grabs me. Let's practice kissing, she said, and gives me a big smack on the mouth. Her mouth tastes like chocolate milk. Ooh, I push away from her and spin around. Silhouetted against the morning sun, a tall man stands in stained khaki work clothes and a straw hat pulled low over his eyes. In his hand is a big bladed tool like the one we saw in the garage. I freeze, and my heart skitters and thumps like my parakeets when I take it out of its cage to play with it. The image of my body lying on the cellar floor like that skinned rabbit burst into my head. It's the crazy man, Carolyn screeches. We tear out of there and don't look back till we hit the screen door of my house. The crazy man tried to get us, Mama. What? Her face blanches. Where? In Miss Parker's cellar, Carolyn says. Mama locks the door and then calls Daddy at the bakery. He is home in a flash, and we all watch him charge up the hill to Miss Parker's garage. A black man emerges from the darkness, holding a sharp, long-handled blade. He eyes Daddy hard, his brow knitting. Daddy, I scream, watch it out! Pretty soon, though, Daddy shakes the man's hand and they're both laughing. I see the black man wave goodbye as my father returns home. He's just the yard man, Daddy tells my mom, the one who makes her garden look so good all year. He was just putting away his tools when he found Danny and Carolyn hiding in there. Said they were smooching. We were not, Carolyn says. He's scared of the dark. I'm so mad I can't get a word out. I'm sorry, honey, Mama says to Daddy. It's just the kids were so terrified. Daddy hugs her, and then they start smooching. In the living room, Ralphie has cartoons on. Carolyn and I flop down beside him on our bellies. Watching Pixie and Dixie, she asks. Ralphie nods, his eyes transfixed in the TV's phosphorescent glow. Two mice with southern accents crash their rocket ship on a planet of giant metal robots. The planet is called Mooney Moolah, which is aluminum spelled backwards. The giant robots chase the little mice around the planet, but at the last moment, Pixie and Dixie escape into a mouse hole. The robots crash into each other and explode. Those little bears killed them, Ralphie says, his eyes beaming. Carolyn looks at me like she wants to say something ugly, but I give her the evil eye and put my finger to my lips.
Daniel Kohler grew up in North Little Rock and is the author of four novels, Flyover Country, The Sleeping Cab, Unbankerly Behavior, and Splitting Washington. His short pieces have appeared in The Best of Tales from the South, The Birmingham Arts Journal, New Works Review, The Rusty Nail, Bareback Magazine, The Storyteller, Inner Sins, The Harvard Bulletin, among others. His books are available on Amazon, Nook, and iBooks. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Alan Reese wants to recapture a moment, and the results are not exactly the same, but magical just the same in Full Moon.
In July of 2007, I threw a pack, tents, boots, and a large dog in the car and headed for Colorado. 2 days later, I sat in a Denver living room groaning over the weather map with two friends, Dancer and the Moonbeam. Those nicknames are real, by the way, and are worthy stories for another time. All of Colorado was rainy, and our backpacking trip was in tatters. We considered Wyoming rainy. New Mexico was rainy. Utah had sunshine, but was so far away. Out of desperation, we looked at western Nebraska, clear and sunny. I had attended high school in a small town there and was familiar with much of the area. Historically, it was Sioux country, and I knew of a state park and a wilderness area, Fort Robinson, an 1870s cavalry post in the canyons and hills where Crazy Horse had been imprisoned and then killed trying to escape. The notion of backpacking in Nebraska seemed massively incongruous, but we thought it might be interesting. A rough terrain of canyons, cactus, and rattlesnakes sounded challenging. There was the question of water, but a glance at a map suggested a number of streams in the area. So we drove to Fort Robinson, geared up, and headed out. My dog Boo, 90 pounds of love, loyalty, and heart, and 800 pounds of fur, led out wearing his own pack. Everyone's mood was high, but as the day wore on, the heat became intense, and we discovered that the hills and canyons weren't tall in mountain terms, but they were very steep and physically demanding. There was little shade, and by mid-afternoon, water was an issue. The streams marked on the map were simply narrow bands of sand sucked dry by desperate cottonwood trees. I was struggling physically and wasn't paying attention to Boo. When he started walking erratically and stumbling, I realized he was in distress. His heavy coat and insufficient water had pushed him into a scary level of dehydration. We gave him our remaining water and then collapsed into a tiny bit of shade. Later in the afternoon, we set up camp under a few pines. Dancer and the Moonbeam went to look for water. They found a source which was so ugly they initially ignored it, but there was no other, so they filtered the water multiple times, and even then it had an evil appearance. We closed our eyes and drank it all. It was at once the grandest and foulest liquid I've ever encountered. After the sun set, the temperature declined, and we sat leaning against packs, tired but recovering, and chatting quietly about the next day's route. Someone noticed what looked like a city's glow to the east, but there was no city to the east. The closest population in any direction was over 10 miles away, a village of 900 people, and it had no glow. It was the rising moon. We were camped high above the narrow head of a long valley that ran and widened easterly for perhaps a mile, then emptied into a larger valley. Ravines and gullies slashed away from it on both sides, and smaller ravines from them. Small clumps of pine formed vague black dots. When the moon finally broke over the horizon, it was immense and exploded over us. We were stunned into silence. We could see with crystal clarity for miles. What had been a hot, prickly, dusty yellow world became moon silver and black. The brightness of the terrain was punctuated by surrealistically long, dark shadows. Every tree, every bump, every rock, every bush, seemingly every blade of grass trailed an extended ebony twin. The ravines and gullies became collections of dark arteries and veins laying on the earth. I stood and my shadow reached far up the slope, and as I moved, a surreal and silent pantomime acted out behind me. For us, the world had become a black and silver impressionist painting. Except for our breathing, it was absolutely silent. The static of the modern world was absent. No cars, no phones, no distant voices or urban sounds, no airplanes above. There was nothing to see or hear that would tell us whether it was 2007 or 1807. Then there were sounds. Coyotes being calling and responding, one far to the west, another south of us, one very close and visible at the bottom of the valley. They were haunting sounds, and I still get goosebumps recalling them. I remember looking at Boo. He had lifted his head momentarily and went back to sleep. Even now, none of us have ever forgotten that night. We sat there long and motionless and silent. I think no one really wanted to speak or move for fear something would change. Eventually, we slipped into tents, the interior of mine glued with moonlight, and sleep was elusive. I thought a lot about water. Boo left the tent and lay just outside. He was on his stomach, paws outstretched, head up. He was sleepy and facing the moon. I could see him close and open his eyes for a long time. After a while, he laid his head down. That night came up in conversations, and we would talk about somehow experiencing it again with wives and friends. A few years later, I was listening to Neil Young's song, Harvest Moon. The imagery of that night and the imagery of that song suddenly merged in my head. That marriage became entrenched, and I became obsessed with the notion of reliving that night and adding music, of going with friends to the top of a hill under a full moon and playing full moon music. The idea wouldn't go away, and I began to toy with a song list. For months, when I heard music of any kind that somehow appealed, I scribbled titles and reminders on post-it notes, on receipts, on the back of checks, on grocery sacks, and once, ridiculously, on the pants I was wearing. It became ludicrous. I lived in a world of confetti. I had notes everywhere and eventually became so exasperated that I tossed everything and started over, but this time with criteria: romantic or haunting or benignly strange. Eventually, a list of 8 songs emerged, and I approached my friends with the idea. I knew they would think me a nutcase, but I also knew that, even though we all live in different states, they would leap in without pause. I spoke, they laughed, and said, "You're a nutcase, let's do it." So in late September, in the time of a full moon, we all drove hundreds of miles to meet again in far northwest Nebraska, back at Fort Robinson. On the day, huge cauliflower clouds began massing and congealing overhead. By dusk, there was no sky and apparently no chance of a moon. I wrapped myself around a beer cooler. I was drenched in self-pity and thinking of horrid things to do to Mother Nature. My friends, being the fine friends that they are, watched and casually debated about the kind of help I needed. The dancer felt more beer was called for, but the moonbeam felt an enema would work better and quicker. Suddenly, the moonbeam's wife dashed in, pulled my thumb out of my mouth, and said, "The clouds are breaking and moving. The moon is up. Let's go." We dashed to the hill we had chosen, tall, open, and far from anything, and spread blankets. There was a small warm breeze, no sound, not even coyotes this night. The moon was already high and bright, with a few drifting clouds remaining. I put a finger on the play button and realized I was very, very nervous. The next half hour had been in my mind for a long time, and I really wanted the experience to be magical for everyone. I had insisted on keeping the songs a secret and could only hope they would affect the others as they had me. I pressed the button and stretched out on the ground. The first piece was a piano and single violin. The violin was long and graceful, and with the first notes, my nervousness vanished. Everything disappeared but moon, music, and friends. Midway through, the violinist began to double string. The sound somehow became visceral and ethereal together, and I found myself tearing up. 27 minutes and 8 very different songs later, it was over. It was everything I had hoped for, but mostly a special memory shared with very special people. During this entire period, beginning to end, there were 2 songs about which I never wavered. The first was the one that had planted the seed, Harvest Moon. The second was the song that even in the beginning I knew would be the finish, a song to throw aural fireworks at the moon. Maybe those of you in my age group would agree. It was Wilson Pickett's In the Midnight Hour. And in case you're wondering, yes, we cranked the volume to nuclear, and a small group of gray-haired men and women got up to shake their happy asses under the moon on a very tall hill in very remote, not so quiet, northwest Nebraska. A special memory. As a footnote, I find myself imagining a warm southern moon with a bit of humidity and the aroma of jasmine. Anyone interested?
Alan Reese likes sticky-floored taverns, cheap red wine, big dogs, and small towns, and is aging with as little dignity as possible. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack in the River Market District of Little Rock, Arkansas. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. Tonight's show is dedicated from all of us here at Tales from the South to Brandy Jo Ford, who lost her battle last week. Thanks for the 20-plus years of friendship, and we'll see you on the other side, my friend. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
This next song here was actually co-written by the two of us. The only song that I've ever co-written, so it's really special. And it's called Blood from a Turnip. Like getting blood from a turnip, water out of a stone. Sometimes there's redemption, even when you're all alone. All day long. Somewhere out on the Little Twin River was a pretty young maid delivering mail. They all said that her mama died too early, and her daddy, they say that he's in jail.
guys got the giggles tonight.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.